Our panel in studio this morning, Tanya Ward, Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance. Good morning, Tanya.
Good morning.
John O'Brien is Professor of European Politics at NUI Maynooth. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
And Hugh O'Connell is a 31-year-old Sagittarius, a Kildare man, a Liverpool fan, who has to be introduced this way because he doesn't start his new job as political correspondent with independent newspapers until tomorrow. Good morning, Hugh.
Good morning, Gavin. Thank you all for
coming in this morning, and happy Father's Day to all of your respective dads. Happy Father's Day, too, to Dominic Riley, who's not listening because he's on holidays in Spain, but he might listen back, so happy Father's Day to him. And also happy Father's Day to Stephen Jordan, who is back in the saddle this morning after a couple of weeks of paternity leave. Hope Cormac is keeping well at home, missing his dad for the first time in a couple of weeks this morning. Front pages of this morning's newspapers. It starts with the Sunday Independent. Top story above the fold there is a story which is covered extensively in a lot of the papers today. Garda chiefs forced Garda to give up her baby. Maeve Sheehan is reporting about this. This is the story of Magella Moynihan, whose case was untold for the first time yesterday in a doc on one on Radio 1. A Garda who was threatened with dismissal for having sex outside of marriage and a child out of wedlock says she feels vindicated and overwhelmed with messages of support after disclosing her story for the first time yesterday. Magella Moynihan said she felt pressured into giving up her baby for adoption when she was 22 and was subjected to an internal disciplinary inquiry just weeks after giving birth. She endured a grueling interrogation about her sexuality after she became pregnant by another recruit at Garda Training College in the 1980s. You might have been hearing on the news that Garda Commissioner Drew Harris and the Minister for Justice Charlie Flanagan have both issued apologies to her for her treatment. The main story, however, today on the Sunday Independent, state companies, 520 grand expenses. Dublin port staff spent more than €520,000 in a year on flights, hotels and entertainment using company credit cards, a Sunday Independent special investigation can reveal. The company's chief executive, Eamon O'Reilly, spent almost €95,000 on his credit card in flights, hotels and other expenses in 2018, including a €5,500 airfare for Dublin Mayor Neil Ring to fly to Chicago. Four executives at the port company, including Mr. O'Reilly, spent close to €270,000 between them last year on their company credit cards on everything from iTunes subscriptions and dishwasher repairs to foreign travel and staff entertainment. More about that inside the paper. They've done quite an extensive study of the credit card expenditure there. Front page of the Sunday Times, actually, on the topic of Father's Day, has a banner across the top. They've got an interview with Liam Gallagher, who's pictured on the top of the paper alongside his three children, Eugene, Lennon and Molly. All three of them cannot be mistaken for being anyone else's kids because they all have his eyebrows, including Molly, God love her. But they all wear them well. Front page story there, though. Poll disaster for Fine Gael as gap opens to rivals. Fine Gael has fallen 5 points behind Fianna Fáil, while support for Sinn Féin has dropped to its lowest level in more than 8 years, according to a behaviour and attitude survey for the Sunday Times. Responses backing Leo Varadkar's party slumped to 23%, the lowest since he became Taoiseach 2 years ago, while Sinn Féin has fallen 7 points to just 12%, 2 points below its 2016 general election results, the poll indicates. Flushed by successes in the European and local elections, the Green Party has risen 5 points to 11%, more than doubling its support in Dublin in just a month, from 8% to 20%. And in the satisfaction ratings, Mary Lou McDonald has fallen 7 points to 32%. The Taoiseach is down 3 to 39%. Micheál Martin down 2, but still at 46%, and still by some distance the most popular leader in the country. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times, labs lost smear tests of 31 cancer patients. The HSE has told 30 women who developed cancer, The HSE has told 30 women who developed cancer and the next of kin of another woman who has died that their cervical smear slides are missing and have been excluded from a clinical review being conducted by Britain's Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists. The women had all agreed to participate in the review. The HSE admitted the samples were missing in phone calls on Wednesday. "I'm absolutely enraged," said one woman who didn't want to be identified. "It's not just because of not being included in the review. This has significantly changed my life. I was only 30 when I got sick. I got two completely different results within 6 months of each other. My treatment brought on the menopause. I can't have children. I want answers, and I don't think I'll ever get them now." Similar story on the whole realm of cervical cancer on the front page of the Sunday Business Post, where, as we've known, the clinics who were involved in the ruling involving Ruth Morrissey in the High Court had already indicated that they wanted to appeal to the Supreme Court. Susan Mitchell this morning tells us that the state is going to do likewise, that the state claims agency will tomorrow apply to the Supreme Court for leave to appeal the ruling of Justice Kevin Cross, which was handed down last month and which saw Morrissey and her husband Paul awarded €2.1 million in compensation. The government had tried to find a way to ensure that the Morrisseys could be financially compensated because it wants to avoid a repeat of the Bridget McCall case, but legal sources said it was difficult and could result in the case collapsing due to the law of mootness. Basically, she goes on to explain that there was some concerns around the ruling of Justice Cross because he described the tests as requiring absolute confidence when samples were given the all clear. Medics have pointed out that absolute confidence is not a standard you can meet when it comes to carbon screening. Also on the front page there, taxpayers facing €7 billion bill for missing carbon's emissions targets. More about that perhaps in the next few minutes. The front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday, hospice's home sold to charity a friend boss. Now, this is a story by Michael O'Farrell. People might remember there being a story about this on the front page of the Mail on Sunday a few weeks back about the sale of a property owned by Our Lady's Hospice in Harold's Cross. Michael O'Farrell reveals this morning that the secret buyer of that property, which was sold for a fraction of its value, is a, quote, family friend of the charity's sacked financial director. The Mail on Sunday claims that Mayo native Michael Mitch Egan is the person who incorporated a secret New York company to buy the Spanish asset at a loss of $300,000 to the publicly funded charity. Sunday Mirror, battered to death in her home. This is the story of Valerie Kilroy, who was found beaten to death at her home in Westbourne in County Mayo on Friday. Her 5-year-old son and twins aged 2 were unhurt. Unfortunately, she was battered to death while her children were in the house, police believe. And also on the front page of the Sunday World, I've killed Valerie, husband's shock claim to Gardaí after mum of 3 found beaten to death. Couldn't get a copy of The Sun on Sunday this morning because everyone in the office is tearing over it trying to find out exactly why Sharif left Love Island. But plenty there to pick over. I think we'll start with the political opinion poll, and I'll come to you, Hugh, first. I can't remember any time in Leo Varadkar's tenure that Fine Gael would be as low as 23%. Yeah. And in fact, even in the last days of Enda Kenny, they were higher in this particular series of polls. What do we learn from that?
Well, I think it's reflective, I suppose, of a public disquiet with Leo Varadkar. He's 2 years Taoiseach this week, in fact. And I think that it's reflective of a series of controversies over the last 6 months, which have eroded the government's credibility, not least the National Children's Hospital, which I think more than most really cut through to an awful lot of the public in their belief that the government was mismanaging an awful lot of money for a facility that is much needed. And Varadkar was on the radio again yesterday extolling the fact that this hospital is much needed and no one will be giving out when it's built. The trouble is, from the government's perspective, it's not going to be built for a few years yet. So I think the poll is also reflective of the kind of post-local and European election narrative, which was that Sinn Féin were in the doldrums. Mm. And you can see that they dropped by 7 points, I think, today.
Yeah, on the back of a 2-point loss in the previous poll as well.
And the Greens up significantly to, I think, 11%, which I don't think is reflective of what they would do in a general election necessarily, but I think is reflective of the fact that we are talking about green issues a lot more, and we are talking about the Green Party a lot more in the wake of their significant gains in the local and European elections. Although those gains not reflective necessarily of what they were projected to get based on the initial exit poll. So, but from Fine Gael's perspective, it's not a good result. It's certainly far from the honeymoon period that Leo Varadkar enjoyed, the extended honeymoon period that Leo Varadkar enjoyed even up until last summer, when I remember sitting with one particular minister who was talking to me about the possibility that Fine Gael could win up to 70 seats. That kind of talk now, a year on, is fanciful, and I think it's reflective as well of the fact that Fine Gael is in a huge battle to try and win the next general election with Fianna Fáil. And you can see that Micheál Martin, notwithstanding the fact he's been around for 20 years as a senior frontline politician, is the most popular party leader in the country. And that's not good for Leo Varadkar, who's been a party leader for all of 2 years.
No, considering how increasingly presidential a lot of these elections are becoming. John, it's about 18 months since Leo Varadkar got a serious bounce in the polls for Fine Gael on the basis of what was perceived as being two fingers to the DUP. Obviously now, perhaps with Brexit looking a little bit more like a crisis coming into the very short-term view on the horizon, maybe that's part of the reason why it's all ebbing away again.
It might be, but I don't think that's the case, actually. If you look at the way the political parties across the board in Ireland have done on Brexit, there have been skirmishes at the margins, but they've remained very united, in a great contrast, of course, to what's happened in the UK. The problem, I think, for the Taoiseach is that the Tory election campaign is unfolding just as his numbers are plunging, and in the aftermath of a difficult enough election. And there's an unpredictability about British politics. There's an unpredictability, of course, about Boris Johnson. So how do you factor that into your decision-making about when to call an election? I think it's incredibly difficult. But I have to say that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil actually would have taken things away from the recent elections. Fianna Fáil had a very good election locally in Dublin, not a very good European election. Fine Gael come back with 5 seats from the Euros. And if you put aside the issue of by-elections, which of course are very important to the Dáil context, I think they'd have taken a lot out of that. And I think we might have to wait for another poll to see whether the trend that's there in the BNI one is confirmed.
Just in terms of calling a general election, I mean, the one thing that will hold the Taoiseach, any Taoiseach, back from calling a general election is the risk that you will not be returned to power. Because, you know, power is a great, it's something you, any Taoiseach really wants to hold on to. I think it's one of the most, you know, kind of all-consuming things that that can get to a Taoiseach. And I think that that, for the Taoiseach's point of view, this kind of poll number aligned with what were, you know, fairly middling local election results in particular would hold the Taoiseach back from calling a general election.
But one of the really fascinating things, I think, is that two out of the three big party leaders are untested in general election campaigns.
But Micheál Martin's the only one who's been there before.
Yeah, and he's a formidable debater, and I wonder how that might work in practice. So is Mary Lou, but she's untested in a general election campaign. Obviously, she has real problems after the Euro and locals, and the Taoiseach himself hasn't been tested in this kind of context.
Tanya, what would you put Fine Gael's loss of public confidence down to? Do you think it's just largely down to the perceived overspending on broadband or the Children's Hospital, or is there more to it than that?
Well, look, there's a combination of things here. They had a difficult local and European election. They had the Children's Hospital on the doors. They've had the broadband debacle, and they've had a flight of votes to the Green Party. I mean, that's clear in terms of the election results if you look at the movement on it. I mean, I'd say there's a lot of reflection going on in Fine Gael, and particularly, I suppose, in Dublin, why they didn't do better on the north side of the city. And I wonder, is that down to their appeal as well, you know, in terms of how they're perceived as Southsiders, a rugby set, irrespective of the kind of decisions that they might be making? Because they have actually made lots of inroads in areas like child poverty. They have made some investments in the education system and the health system, but they haven't won any additional votes in relation to that. So I think that's something they're going to be thinking about. I mean, at this stage, it would be reckless to call a general election with the uncertainty that around Brexit and with Boris Johnson looking like he's going to be the main contender for the Tory party leadership. But it does give them, I suppose, an opportunity, and Leo Varadkar in particular, an opportunity when you think of how well they've led on Brexit, gives them an opportunity to come back up onto the polls. Because I think that's one area where they have done well consistently. They've built consensus at government level. They've done well throughout Europe to get other European countries to back them, and they did well in negotiations with Theresa May. So he has an opportunity there, I think, when it comes to the election of Boris Johnson and the next steps that he might take.
It's funny that you mentioned that, actually, because one thing that strikes me is that if Fine Gael were to call a general election, I'm not really sure what the general plan or slogan would be, because I suspect that they would probably still say that there's a case to be made for reanimating, maybe not in as many words, but the sentiment of keep the recovery going. And then yet, when you look at Jodie Corcoran's piece on page 21 of the Sunday Independent today, Hugh, over his piece is a graph of the KBC Bank ESRI Consumer Sentiment Index, and what it shows is that for the last 3 years people have felt that the economy is doing okay or beginning to do well, and then the first couple of months of this year people's perceptions about how well the economy was doing appear to have completely tanked. And if they're going to run on the premise of being the only capable people managing the economy, whatever you say about fiscal prudence and the fiscal council, that people just generally don't seem to think that the recovery is meeting their doorstep.
No, and it's an interesting piece by Jody, because I think he spoke to Paul Moran from Cantor Millward Brown, who they test consumer sentiment, and he asked them why it was so low, and he points out that there was a variety of factors, but cervical check, the National Children's Hospital. I mean, I know I keep banging on about that, but the National Children's Hospital, from talking to politicians who were on the doors during the local and European elections, came up consistently as something that the public were really, really annoyed about, that this had spiraled out of control and was really a shocking mismanagement of public money. But things like cervical check as well, the two-tier recovery, the recovery in Dublin that isn't necessarily reflected in the towns and villages, the further west you go in this country. I mean, it is worth noting that graph, I think, only goes up to February. No deal Brexit was on the horizon, and the risk of a no deal Brexit was arguably at its greatest. So that is worth noting, I suppose. Yeah. But people are worried about Brexit as well. They're also, I suppose, worried about the fact that we've had economic growth for a number of years now. We've had unemployment come down substantially in the last half decade or so. And people, I suppose, are mindful of the fact that we're not that far away from the crash, and they're worried about the possibility that there's another crash coming. And they see Brexit, and they see the trade wars going on internationally, and they are worried about that, I suppose.
And I'd say the other thing that's hitting their pocket, because I agree with all of that, is the price of rent and housing. Because while people might be doing well work-wise, they might be getting jobs, they might be getting pay increases, fortunately the cost of rent is rising exponentially. So, you know, even in my own area, I'm looking at how 3-bedroom houses to rent, and they're like 2,400, way beyond what a lot of families are going to be able to afford. And I think unless we get a grip of the housing crisis, I don't think people at home will feel the benefits of it all.
I'm just looking, by the way, you're right to point that out to you, that the graph finishes in February, but I've just managed to pull up the consumer sentiment indexes for March and April. And in March, it came back a little bit. It came back from about 86 points to 93. Anything below 100, by the way, is generally considered as being downward spiral. Anything above 100 is that people feel confident. So it was around 86 in February. It rose to 93 in March, which is still downward, but not nearly as much. And then in April, it fell down to 87.7 again. So there does appear to be a sustained view in some people's minds that it's not really going too well. John, there's a lot of pieces in the papers today, particularly in the aftermath of the Fiscal Council's report this week. Colin McCarthy in the Sindo, Finance Watchdog pulls no punches. Pascal's forecast is simply not credible. There's an editorial there about how the government has to heed the fiscal warning. Eddie Casey's in the Business Post, public finances policy is drifting into a storm. Editorial there says the party of prudence needs a swift fiscal reality check. Sunday Times editorial, Fine Gael traded in its reputation for fiscal prudence. It seems that it's very difficult for Fine Gael to find any sympathetic hearings, that they are in fact being as prudent with the public finances as they might like people to think.
Yeah, finance ministers always, of course, have to deal with almost infinite demands for spending in sectoral areas, and those things, those demands ratchet up with a general election in prospect. But I think here there are multiple things kind of intersecting. Some of it is what's happening in our two nearest parishes in the United States and in the UK. Some of it is about the cost overruns that Hugh talked about in broadband, National Children's Hospital. But I think it kind of goes further than that, what looks like a very buoyant economy at one level, and where, you know, confidence should be rising, wages are rising, not at the same level of the growth rate, but certainly they are rising in both private and public sector. But it is not translating into increased support for the government. And I think it really is about the proximity of the last crisis and the fear that another one may be coming down the line. And I think Tanya is absolutely right about the cost base. I have a friend who's moving from the UK to take up a job at UCD, and she's absolutely shocked, not just at housing, but childcare costs. When you factor that in, your actual net wage reduces to a level that is not very attractive. And I think across the board, I mean, people feel that the recovery may be happening, but it's not really positively impacting them.
Does that point, Tanya, to a perception that maybe people feel like that there's just rising inequality, that if all the headline figures look great and we see all these extra employment now down to 4.6% unemployment, and headline figures are going up and GDP keeps going up, and even a hard Brexit won't necessarily result in job losses, but rather just fewer jobs being created, and yet people really don't seem to think that that's coming to their own doorsteps?
I mean, that's right. And I think it's because everyday life is still hard for a lot of families in Ireland. There's too many families living on the breadline, really sinking, you know, in poverty because of the everyday costs that they have to deal with. So the price of food, the price of housing, the price of healthcare. I mean, one of the things that hasn't changed since 2005 is the threshold for medical cards, you know. And medical cards give you free access to your GP, but also help you with the cost of buying medicines, give you access to free transport. And there's a lot of working people in Ireland at the moment on very low incomes that would do well if they had access to a medical card. And I think there's some of the things that we need to be thinking about if we're going to let people feel like they're part of this recovery.
Do you think points like that lead people to think that Fine Gael are a little bit emotionally tone deaf, that they might be very good at looking at the books in a very cold and clinical way, but that they don't appreciate the human impact of a lot of these things, which might be part of the reason why they're down 5 points in the polls?
Yeah, I mean, there could be a perception of that. But actually, if you look in other areas of the investments that they've made, they have actually listened to the advocates and the community groups working with people on the breadline. So if you look at the last budget in particular, you see investments, particularly for low-income families. So if you're on welfare payments at the moment, you get an extra €5 now if you have a child between the age of 12 and 18, because we know actually that older children cost more to raise. Those families are really struggling, particularly in rural Ireland and around the border counties. They also increase the weekly payment for direct provision. But I think if you look at other government departments, I think what's happening is one government department, the Department of Social Protection and Department of Children and Youth Affairs, are kind of leading the charge when it comes to addressing child poverty. But the other government departments have to be playing their role as well. And particularly in health, you know, where you want to be seeing the investments taking place is medical cards. You want to see more public health nurses. You want to see better access to GP care and primary care throughout the country. And that was one of the things I picked up from the Fiscal Council report from during the week, was they said, look, the investments in the children's hospital and investments in broadband will mean the government doesn't have the money it needs to invest in primary care. And we know one of our problems in Ireland in the healthcare system is that the acute hospital system is carrying too much. And actually, if we invested more in your primary care and your local GP services, if ordinary people could get to them, we'd save a lot of money in the long run.
John, briefly before
but it's also about the inability to control health spending. I mean, a lot of the capital spending that's projected is for productive infrastructure that will pay off in the longer term, but you can't spend that money if every year the overrun in health is 200, 500, 700 million. It's extraordinary. The entire increase in the education budget this year was 150 million. The overrun in HSE was four times that. So it's about that inability to control big spending departments. That is a real problem.
I thought it was fascinating to hear Leo Varadkar say yesterday that they're effectively writing two budgets, one for a hard Brexit and one for without one, and then also saying that although things would be tighter than last year, that public spending would still be increasing by 5%, which would be no mean increase.
He did say as well, didn't he, that he would have to make the government might have to make decisions that some people would see as not very passionate or not very compassionate. So that to me indicates that there's going to be some decisions potentially taken in this government that or in this budget that will increase that perception that the government is not very compassionate towards those most in need.
The thing I hope that does land with them, though, is, you know, tax cuts. Get tax cuts out the window, because at the end of the day, what people want is their parents not being on a trolley in a hospital. They want to know that there's a school place for their child when they turn five. They want to know that childcare is going to be affordable. I think those things are far more important. I know yesterday I listened to Leo Varadkar, I was thinking, God, we better have two submissions for the two different budgets. Okay. We better have two different answers.
We look forward to seeing exactly which two budgets the Children's Rights Alliance might have its hands on, having some influence in.
They would be prepared to look at a deal that meant we didn't need a backstop. And what I'm saying is, should we not try? I'm not saying this is going to be easy, but what they say is, if you've got an idea, we don't have a border with the Republic of Ireland, you do. And if you've got an idea, then we'll look at it.
Conservative leadership contender Jeremy Hunt speaking to the BBC's Andrew Marr this morning, again saying something he's been saying for a while, which is that European politicians would be prepared to look again at a Brexit deal that doesn't involve a backstop. More on that later in the show. And I did have to be careful, by the way, when I introduced his surname as Hunt, not because it's an error that a lot of people have made, but also someone has kindly texted in to point out that I referred to carbon screening instead of cervical screening earlier on when I was going through the front pages. Thank you for that correction. But we will return now to the topic of cervical screening, because Justine McCarthy's story on the front page of the Sunday Times to me is quite striking. The HSE has told 30 women who developed cancer and the next of kin of another woman who has died that their cervical smear slides are missing and therefore have to be excluded from the clinical review being conducted by Britain's Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists. And you make the point when you look at this that this isn't 31 slides which might have been lost in the grand total of hundreds of thousands, in which case you might say that it's acceptable that some things would slip through the cracks. But Tanya Ward, this is 30 women who developed cancer and the next of kin of another woman who died, which would suggest that they've lost 31 smears that belong to the group of 221 women, which is a really worrying ratio, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very high number. And without understanding what happens in in the labs, it's difficult to know what the reason was behind it, but it won't actually instill confidence in people around the cervical check programme. And I think those kinds of things really do need to be addressed. You have to have some level of confidence that they can manage the smear tests. I think more broadly, what's coming up, and there's a lot of coverage in the papers about the cervical check case, and much deeper analysis as well of the Morrissey judgment, is the need to look at how the whole system is running at the moment and looking at the viability of the system at the moment. I think a lot of people before this crisis emerged thought that, you know, cervical check told you whether you had cancer or not, and that doesn't do that. No. It tells you whether you have potential abnormalities
or not. The propensity to develop it.
That's right. And I think that they're going to have to, after the Morrissey judgment, they're going to have to do a public education awareness program in relation to the program. But they're also going to have to look at how it can be improved going forward. And one of the things that I know they're planning is the notion that people would also have HP vaccine or HPV tests as well alongside your smear test. So, you know, generally HPV is present when cervical cancer is present as well, or abnormalities are present. And it's probably the best predictor alongside your smear test that actually you might have smear tests. So I think something big or radical like that will have to be rolled out to instill confidence from women and girls about the cervical check programme.
I think that's the plan, isn't it?
Yeah,
to roll that out.
Yeah.
Justine's piece also says that there are 36 slides which also couldn't be included, which relate to 31 women, which couldn't be retrieved by the laboratories in time to meet a deadline, according to a spokeswoman for the HSE, and therefore can't be included either, which is also equally troubling. And in a week where there's been so much in the second report of Gabriel Scally discussing how 10 of the 16 laboratories being used to retest, the HSE didn't even know about it. It's hardly a good first step in trying to rebuild that confidence.
So I think what Tanya said is absolutely right. It's about, you know, the erosion of confidence in this screening program has been huge over the last year and a half. And to get
despite
that,
its success, I mean,
despite its obvious success, this story, the Vicky Phelan story, Ruth Morrissey, all these Emma Vic Nahuna, the late Emma Vic Nahuna, all of these, all of this controversy has served to erode public confidence in the cervical check program. Therefore, the government, I think, needs to overhaul it to such an extent that you have things like that, not only the rollout of the HPV vaccine, but HPV testing as well, and just basically overhaul it to such an extent that it is utterly different from the system that we have right now, because confidence is so utterly eroded in that system. And stories like Justine McCarthy's today only serve to do more damage to that. And also the fact that, you know, the front page of the Sunday Business Post talking about the state going to appeal the judgment in the Morrissey case,
which you can understand perhaps
the Supreme Court,
the rationale of, but it's not really a good look.
It's not a good look at all. And I think the story notes that there's concern in government about how this is going to be perceived in the public domain. And you know, obviously the public looking at this are going to think this isn't a great thing to do. This is a woman, Ruth Morrissey, who got a judgment in her favour. But I think it's the wording of the judgment and some of the wording used in the judgment that is of concern to the state, which is why they're appealing it.
Someone has just tweeted in to say, by the way, that aside from making those comments about how the EU would be prepared to reconsider the backstop, Jeremy Hunt also commented that he'd like to lower the corporate tax rate in Britain to 12.5%, similar to Ireland, hoping to take in some of the corporate tax revenue that Ireland is currently getting but also not getting. I might talk about more about that in part three. John, your thoughts on both the two stories this morning and on the fallout of the Scally report earlier this week?
Well, I think for a government that's obsessed with spin and controlling the flow of information, this is going to be very difficult. I mean, you could not find people in our society who elicit more sympathy than people who have gone through what Ruth Morrissey and her family went through, Vicky Phelan and others. But I think, you know, they were in a complete bind after what Judge Cross said and about this test, the threshold for absolute confidence. I think it was inevitable that this would end up in court, but the human dimension is, of course, is extraordinary, and it could really be very problematic, I suspect, for the government in the months to come.
Yeah, and I suspect that could be one of the difficulties, Tanya, isn't it? Because you mentioned there that this is ultimately the results of all of this, the audits that are carried out on smear tests after a woman is later registered as having developed cancer. It's all supposed to be well intended, because it's supposed to lend itself to further knowledge and understanding that it's a good practice thing that most other countries don't do. And yet it's in trying to pursue that good practice that the HSE and the screening service and the state have managed to completely balls this up, frankly.
They botched it a bit because they decided not to communicate or find a way to communicate the results of the audit to the women that were affected. The thing I think that comes through on this is, and the government is in the bind, because if they compensate Ruth Morrissey, and I'm sure they want it, because why would you want to put her through any more litigation? She has a life-limited condition. She doesn't have much more time left. And at the same time, if they don't appeal, they leave a new standard on the books, which is absolute confidence. So the people reading the tests have to be sure that there are, that there's no abnormalities on the tests. What does come through from the coverage, though, today is there's some other perspectives. I saw Ashley Mulligan, who's a barrister, quoted saying that actually she doesn't think it'll have the impact that people say it'll have. It'll just mean that screeners will have to err on the side of caution. And on the other side, the medical practitioners are saying, no, it'll result in unnecessary testing on healthy patients.
Yeah, John.
Actually, Danielle Barron in the Sunday Business Post, a very, very good
very
post.
Good piece on page 14 there.
Yeah, it uses the example from the UK of the Penny case in 1999. And she says the outcome of that is very clear, that actually it didn't have, it was very similar in terms to the issues before the court in the Morrissey case, but it actually didn't have an adverse effect on screening. And actually, in the longer term, screening has actually improved in the UK. Yeah. So that's something perhaps
although
we should keep
she does quote, in fairness, just for a bit of balance, Danielle Barron also quotes another barrister who says that the ruling in Britain was a little bit more nuanced, because the absolute confidence referred to in that judgment only referred to the particular slides that were central to the case. And it was possible to it wasn't extrapolated, basically, that the standard in that case could apply to every other case as well. But obviously, Irish medics now have concerns that if you're told to have absolute confidence before you make a determination on a slide, that cancer screening just doesn't lend itself to absolute confidence, because
there's a good section in that piece where it quotes Dr. Paul Cross, the president of the Association of Cytopathology. I'm really glad I pronounced that word correctly. Basically, he's observed some of the reaction in Ireland from the medical profession. Says a lot of it reads very knee-jerk. People are hearing what they're hearing but going to an illogical conclusion. And so he kind of concurs with this idea that Ashley Mulligan was talking about, that actually the absolute confidence test wouldn't necessarily have an adverse impact on them on the programme here. But the programme here is so utterly damaged from the negative headlines over the last year and a half that you have to wonder what the future is.
And the other thing that really struck me from Janelle Barron's article is the whole notion that is this adversarial system of justice the best place to resolve these kinds of issues? Because the women in these cervical check cases, their legal teams took the cases on the basis of no fail, no win. And actually most Irish people in Ireland, most people in this country cannot afford to go down to the courts to assert their rights because you need to have a legal team that will back you up. On the same side, you need to think about the cost that could be awarded against you if you lose. And so there's a real issue, actually, if you are a victim of something like this, how do you get your rights addressed?
Well, on that topic, and Hugh, I wanted to come to you about this because you have the similar burden as me of having to watch a lot more dull proceedings than is healthy for your standard rational human being.
Yes.
But with so much of how time in Leinster House has been occupied by the fallout of the cervical check crisis in the last 12 months or so, I'm a little bit shocked when you see that there hasn't really been any concrete legislative process or progress on introducing that non-adversarial tribunal that Tani was talking about. And moreover, that when we were told 12 months ago the government would legislate to put mandatory open disclosure on a legal footing, that there hasn't been any progress in doing that either.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's very hard to see how the government, which reacted so badly, I suppose, to this crisis in the first place last year, has not kind of learned any lessons from that and has not sought to advance any of the things that you talked about there. And that it does appear, despite, continuing negative headlines about this whole cervical check programme coming out, that the government has made little by way of legislative progress in this area. That goes back on the Minister, Simon Harris. It's another example, I think, of the Minister for Health saying something, saying that the government is going to do something, saying that he's going to do something, and that when it comes to it, not actually getting that legislation over the line.
No doubt he will tell us that he has a list the length of his arm of other things that people want to get through and that it's difficult getting legislation through, but
this is something that he would have made a priority of his. He talks repeatedly of his good relationship with the likes of Vicky Phelan and others, and they have spoken well of him, no doubt about that, but they have not spoken so well of Leo Varadkar, for example. But has he delivered on this front so far legislatively? Not really, no.
People were saying to me there that they haven't seen a game of that quality or that atmosphere in Parnell Park for a hurling game before. And it's great for Dublin Hurling and great for this bunch of guys, and hopefully we can grow and improve from now on.
Dublin hurling manager Matty Kenny talking after the Dubs 4-point victory over Galway in Parnell Park last night, a result which put the 2017 All-Ireland champions out of this year's All-Ireland Senior Hurling Championship. More on that and the rest of the weekend sport coming up in the next hour here on News Talks on the Record. Still going through the Sunday papers here with Tanya Ward, John O'Brien and Hugh O'Connell. Tanya, we wanted to talk to you about the a lot of the coverage that's in this morning's papers about the case of Majella Moynihan, whose story was told very beautifully by all accounts on the Dock on One yesterday. The Garda, who was threatened with dismissal for having sex outside of marriage and a child outside of wedlock, and who was effectively forced by not only the Garda force but by the state and to a certain degree the church to give up the baby that she had no interest in giving up.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary radio documentary because it really takes you back to Ireland in the 1980s, and it's a story I wasn't actually familiar with, and I'm surprised because I work in and campaign within this area. And, you know, she tells the story of being a 22-year-old woman. She gets into the Guards, that she's proud to be a Garda cadet, that she's diligent. All her supervisors say she's brilliant at what she does, and she falls pregnant with another, and the father is another guard. And the relationship is one that she wants to continue, and she hides the fact that she's pregnant. She's terrified to tell people that she's pregnant. She goes to Cura, which is one of the Catholic pregnancy agency. Yes. At the time, they deal with her very compassionately and help her tell the guards that she's pregnant. Mm. But the response she gets is extraordinary. She's put under tremendous pressure by everyone around her to give her baby up. And so she does. She's terrified to tell her father. And what comes through is just the loss of this woman and her son, David, that she was denied the opportunity to raise her child. And this is even, you know, well after the unmarried mother's payment is introduced in 1973. But in an institution like the Gardaí, that's so patriarchal and misogynist at the time, she was singled out and mistreated by everyone around her. And the only reason she doesn't get sacked is because of an intervention by the Archbishop, and says if you sack her, you'll get more guards going to England to have an abortion, and she's cautioned. But the other thing that's extraordinary is when her ex-partner is being disciplined around it. She gets subjected to an interrogation about her own sex life and about why they didn't use contraception when she got pregnant. And he gets fined £90, and she was charged. Well, extraordinary episode in Irish history.
I wanted to ask, because I have to confess, I didn't get to hear the documentary yesterday, and I'm looking forward to getting to hear it back at some other point. But the one thing that strikes me about the way it's summarised by Maeve Sheehan on page one of the Sunday Independent, she was threatened with dismissal, and the two charges against her were having sex outside of marriage and a child outside of wedlock. I presume there was no suggestion about the male Garda, who was also a trainee member of the force, that he should be subject to any of the same social pillorying as Majella Moynihan seems to have been.
That's right. I mean, it doesn't seem he got the same same harsh response from the Gardaí at all.
The disciplinary hearing and he was fined £90
in Donegal. That's what happened. Yeah. And she's the one that the guards crawled all over. But the thing that really struck me, I mean, my mum was a lone parent, and I was listening to that documentary thinking, thank God, because she was one of the first of her generation to keep her baby in the 1970s. And the reason why it was possible for my mum was that she had the backing of her parents, and we were able to live with my grandparents. And you just see the loneliness of people out there and women out there, even up into the 1980s. If you didn't have your family backing you, it just wasn't possible to keep your baby.
I was reminded of this week after the death, sadly, of Philomena Linnett, because she not only had Phil, but she had two other children out of wedlock in the UK in the late 1950s, early 60s. And the fear that people like that had about the judgment that would be cast upon them. I often compare the Ireland that I grew up in to that of the Iranian mullahs, that women were treated to that kind of experience on an almost regular basis. And it was officers of the state priests and people in the clergy who did that.
Just on a total gear change and a bit of a clumsy segue, I hope people will forgive me, but this is why we can't have nice things. There's a nice piece on page 3 of the Sunday Times, which says that it was the location for Fine Gael TD Maria Bailey's notorious swing mishap in 2015. Now the Dean Hotel's glazed rooftop terrace could itself be in peril after Dublin City Council ruled that it shouldn't have been built without planning permission in the first place. The local authority confirmed last week that it had launched planning enforcement proceedings against the hotel over the unauthorised structure. Ontashka brought the rooftop canopy's lack of planning permission to the attention of officials last year. It claimed that the canopy broke the, quote, uniform Georgian parapet of Harcourt Street, which is Dublin's only curving Georgian street. Planning inspector from the council visited the hotel in October and concluded that both a glazed screen and retractable canopy were unauthorised. The Dean's owner later applied for planning retention, but withdrew the application in April, shortly before a decision was due to be made. Hugh, just as a by the by, does it surprise you at all that we that the Taoiseach hired a senior counsel, gave him 2 weeks to look at the Maria Bailey case, and 2 weeks have come and passed and there's still no sign of it, and that no, maybe this will get kicked to the long grass?
Yeah, look, I think the Taoiseach's going to come under pressure next week to, or rather Fine Gael will come under pressure next week to disclose the findings of this I don't even know what you'd call it, this inquiry by the senior counsel next week, and to publish its findings. It's hard to see how it would take any longer than 2 weeks to get to the bottom of all this, given that there's not that many players involved.
Didn't he say yesterday that the report's going to Maria Bailey first and she has a chance to comment on it, and he's going to be last to see it?
Which is due process, and which is fair. But I think that the pressure will definitely grow this week for some outcome of this whole controversy. And for, I mean, from Fine Gael's perspective and from the Taoiseach's perspective and from Maria Bailey's perspective, they'll all want to put this to bed fairly sharpish, otherwise the questions will continue, the controversy will continue. I mean, we saw the focus shift towards Alan Farrell, another Fine Gael TD who had a personal injury case last week. So I think from Fine Gael's perspective, the best thing that they could do is get this resolved one way or the other next week.
A couple of tweets into us at News Talk FM or at Gav Riley, or use the hashtag On The Record. Maria says she's convinced that Fine Gael is delaying or just refusing to legislate in any area so that they won't offend any potential voter. They've been practically inactive for years until the 2 weeks before the local elections, she says. Martina Callanan makes a very fair point. She's taking issue with the use of the phrases out of wedlock or falls pregnant. She asks us, please update your language when you're discussing Magella, Gavin Riley and guests. Please quote directly from the historical records if you like to, but please avoid this language in your own speech, which is a fair point and very well made. John, we promised people before the break we were going to have to talk a little bit about Boris Johnson. Is there any chance of any other genuinely viable contender making it into the top two so that Boris Johnson can be kept out of number 10 by the Conservative Party membership?
Not in my view. I mean, the people who are immediately behind him are, you know, they think exactly the same on Brexit. I think there are settled views about them. He got 114 votes the other day. I don't see any possibility that one of those could come to overtake him. The guy that really has momentum looking at the future is Rory Stewart. I mean, it's been extraordinary what's happened to him. And he's been able to differentiate himself from the others because he is a moderate in every sense, not just on Brexit, but he seems entirely sensible and even compassionate. Yeah. There's a thing for a Tory. So there's a debate this evening on Channel 4.
Yes.
And that will be followed by another on Tuesday. The expectation is that Rory Stewart will be out by Tuesday. And this is the reason Boris Johnson refuses to take part this evening, as far as I can recall, because he doesn't want to face Rory Stewart. So
which is interesting, considering that Rory Stewart polled the lowest of the six surviving candidates in that first round during the week. The Guardian's TV review yesterday, or TV preview rather, it summarised tonight's debate, which starts at 6:30 on Channel 4, summarised it thusly: that the UK is bound for hell in a hand-assisted vehicle, there is little doubt. All that remains is to discover which of these escapees from Pandora's box will taxi us there. A more wretched collection of dissemblers, idiots, narcissists and people who have mistakenly taken drugs is difficult to imagine under one studio roof. But here we are, an asbestos-clad Krishnan Guru Murthy meets the contenders before an audience drawn from across this broken aisle. God actually help us. Not all that hysterical really, Hugh, is it?
No. But I agree with John. I think it's very hard to see beyond Boris at this stage. You even see a lot of the coverage in the papers today is kind of what Boris would be like as leader. Andrew Gilligan has a very good piece in the Sunday Times. The current journalist, who worked with Boris in City Hall in London for 3 years as his cycling czar, talking about what Boris would be like as a leader and what he was like as a chief executive of London, and pointing out, in fact, that he was quite a good mayor of London. I mean, he got two terms. Polls showed that he probably would have been elected for a third term if he had been allowed to run in 2016. And that actually, at his core, Boris is a guy who just wants to be liked. And, you know, wants the public to love him. And so I think that, you know, withstanding what he has said in relation to leaving without a deal in October, I do think there's a possibility that Boris Johnson will not take Britain out of the European Union without a deal in October, purely because it would be so unpopular in Britain because of the actual tangible effect it would have on British people.
So you think that when he's the one who's standing at the cliff edge, when that he won't take the jump?
When push comes to shove, I'm not sure that Boris will follow the line taken by the ERG and Jacob Rees-Mogg and the hardline Brexiteers.
And I think the way he does it is to accept a Northern Ireland-only backstop. He throws the DUP under the bus. It triggers a general election, but I think Boris Johnson probably fancies his chances of getting an overall majority, because that campaign would have, it would, Brexit wouldn't be an issue for the most part, and he would be able to then paint Jeremy Corbyn as this existential threat to the future.
His entire political career has been building towards this moment. Everything he has done in his political career has been building towards getting to number 10 Downing Street. And when he gets there, I think what we have to look at is his record as Mayor of London. And he was actually quite a good mayor of London.
Okay.
The thing that really struck me about the whole thing, I mean, apart from getting over my sinking feeling when I saw Boris Johnson was out in front of everyone else, is how in a country of 66 million people, Boris Johnson is the one who's the main contender of the Tory party. It's pretty extraordinary that this small group of elite schools has so much control and dictating the future of this country. And I have to say, I don't think he's the man to lead them out of the biggest political crisis that they've had.
But who is?
You know, in peacetime. Well, I mean, Rory Stewart, at least he's saying he's a unifier, because what's going on in the UK is complete polarisation between the left and the right. They're at a cliff when it comes to Brexit. They have more working poor than they've ever had before. You've working people now in the UK who are going to food banks the first time in their lives to survive. And at the other side of it is what's happening in Northern Ireland. Boris Johnson doesn't give a toss. Boris Johnson, he has one of the poorest moral compasses of anyone in politics in the UK at the moment. The only compass he has is the Boris compass.
His whole career has been characterised by lies. He is an inveterate liar. He shares an enormous amount in common with Trump. He doesn't read his briefing documents. People who encountered him as Foreign Secretary simply thought he was a disgrace and a joke. Is he going to change his behaviour?
I do think that, you know, when he, his problem, I think, and again, just go back to this Gilligan piece in the Sunday Times, he, you know, when he applies himself, he can actually be quite good. When he reads the brief, he can actually be quite good. But the problem when he's Foreign Secretary, going to people around him, is that he was bored. Now, that's not a good way to operate, obviously. But when you're Prime Minister, I doubt you'll be bored. I mean, I take what Tanya's saying. I don't think that he is the cream of the crop in terms of British politicians, but he is what we are going to be stuck with, inevitably.
Someone texts in just to point out that there may be slightly lesser chance of Boris throwing the DUP under the bus, given that he spoke at one of their last annual conferences and was very well received, so perhaps he might find that bridge a little harder to burn down. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you all for coming in on a Sunday morning. Really appreciate your time. Tanya Ward, Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, John O'Brennan, Professor of European Politics at NUI Maynooth, and Hugh O'Connell, who starts tomorrow as political correspondent within independent newspapers, and in the meantime will just have to be referred to as a 31-year-old Sagittarius.